I'm Alan Cone. I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. I'm also a traveling salesman. I went to an AA meeting down in South Georgia and met our speaker tonight. And I found out she was a farmer's daughter. So after the meeting, I asked her to go home, if I could take her home. She said I could. And I tried to kiss her goodnight, and she wanted to hold hands and pray the Lord's Prayer. I do call Beverly my South Georgia sponsor. She has meant a lot to me. I've been to meetings down there with her for over 3 years, man. She has been quite an influence on my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've spent a lot of hours over the coffee cup sharing one-on-one, and she's just a real special person to me. And it's a good moment in my life to introduce to you our speaker tonight, Beverly W. from Valdosta Unity Group.
Hi, I'm Beverly White, and I'm from Valdosta, and I'm an alcoholic. And yes, Alan and I are real good friends, and the friendship goes back a long way. I met Alan before any of us came into AA, and my ex-husband and I were out chuking one night, and Alan happened to be in the same party we were in. And I believe Alan asked me to dance, sort of like, you want to dance? And I think I said, yeah. And it was just, Alan was not a happy person. I used to think, God, that's the most miserable son of a gun I ever saw in my life, you know. And the first time I saw him come into AA, I thought, oh my God, what's he doing up here? And then it dawned on me, well, dummy, what are you doing up here? And Alan is my mentor. He gets on my case when it needs it, gives me encouragement when I need it. But I'll say this much for Alan Cone. I have never needed to be gotten on to, that he ever put stripes on my back, that he ever failed to put the healing oil there too, because Alan is real first-class AA in my book. I would like to say that anything I say tonight is definitely my opinion, because some of the things I might say might not be too agreeable to some of you people, but these are the things that I have come up with in my period of time in AA. I'm not a native of Georgia. My home state is Ohio. And all this mess got started a lot of years ago up there in that cold country. I was born the youngest of six children, and I was born into a real nice Midwestern family. We weren't poor people, but we weren't rich people. We're pretty well off. By the standards in the little area that I grew up in, some people thought we were rich. By the standards of the world, we just kind of ordinary folks. My father had retired to the country and had settled down on a farm. And all right. Now, is that better? All right. My father had retired to the country and bought a farm and was just settled down to be a gentleman farmer. And lo and behold, my mother came up with me. And my mother wasn't much younger than I am right now when I was born. And prior to my being born, she had lost two children in the space of 1 year, an infant child and a little girl that was 5 years old. They died a few months apart. And my mother had a nervous breakdown, and afterwards I've always been told that she was never the same after that breakdown. She was never a loving, warm person, and I used to kind of laugh and say that for a kid that didn't have a mother, I didn't turn out too badly. We were kind of gapped out in years. I have a sister that's old enough to be my mother, who more or less raised me for the first 5 years of my life. And I had a brother that was 13 years older than I, and a sister 9.5 years older than I. And with all these people so much older, they threw me a pretty rough trick. You always hear that the baby of the family turns out to be bad because it's so spoiled, and I don't agree with that. That's the hardest role in the world to play, because when you're the baby of the family, you're supposed to live up to everybody's expectations, and if they've been a failure, they want you to make up for their life through you. And if you have children who are the baby of the family, kind of look out for them, because it's not an easy role to play. It had a great influence on me. I went to school and found out that I wasn't going to school for me. I was following an act, this older brother and the sisters that had preceded me. But in my earliest coming up, my sister that's almost 18 years older than I, did not get along with my father. And there was much friction. And since she looked after me, she used me as her leveling agent at getting to my father. he idolized me, and so she taught me to hate him. And I remember, I was scared to death of that man. And I would sit and look at him, and I'd think, why are you so mean? And then it would dawn on me, well, he's never really done anything to me. Of course, they were at it all the time. And I grew up with much conflict in my mind where this man was concerned. And when I was 5, she left home, and she got married. And it was then that we began this growing together, and I found that for every one step he took, I took 2 steps trying to keep up. And he was one of the few social drinkers I've ever known in my life. A drink with him was on a very high occasion, to seal a business deal or if his brothers came to visit. And liquor was in the house, but it wasn't anything that... It was a big nothing. It was so unimportant. You didn't even realize it was there. He was pillar of the community, pretty much ran the county that we lived in, and he was very active in politics, although he never sought office. And I always knew who I was and what I was, and I always took great pride in the fact that I was his daughter. The proudest thing in my life is that I belonged to him. Mother, well, I loved her, but I just could never get close to her, and Mother always forgot to buy me clothes. We'd get ready to go someplace, and it was really comical to decide what they were going to put on me because I'd outgrown my prissy clothes from the last time we went someplace, and if the store was open, I got all rigged out and new. If not, I was told, don't take your coat off because your dress is too short. And it was just one of those things. And then when I got old enough, he took me aside and said, look, you know how your mother is. Whenever you need something, you just go to the store and take money out of the register and go get whatever you want. Well, I was taught with every privilege comes a responsibility. And for the privilege of having about anything I wanted, I felt there was a responsibility owed. So I made myself very busy and very useful there at home. He, when I was born, decided to go back into business, and he had a store. And I worked in that. And, of course, we had a farm. There was always something to do there, and I loved to get out on the farm and do all sorts of little things. And I stayed real busy in school because he was proud of good grades. And here came a bit of competition. I found out what kind of grades my brother and sisters had made in school, so I decided I'd do better than they did. My sister had graduated with more credits than anybody in our high school, so when I came out of high school, I had even more credits than she did. She had to crack the books, and I found out if I showed up in class and paid attention, I didn't have to. If there was something that had to be turned in paperwork, it got turned in. Otherwise, I never studied. I was lucky I didn't have to. That gave me a lot of time for mischief. And I was always in trouble in school. It used to be a joke that every time something happened, the principal would come to me and he'd say, Beverly, if you didn't do it, you know who did. Well, I usually did. I usually helped instigate it, too. We did little foolish things like steal a pair of black bloomers off a clothesline down the river bottoms one time and hoisted them on the flagpole, and March winds up there pretty rough, and it swelled them up and disrupted the whole school and block down there. For all the fuss they made about it, I noticed the teachers standing over the side just dying laughing as hard as all those kids were. And of course, they to this day have never found out. They suspected. I know exactly who did it. But it was just little pranky things like that all the time. I got on through high school and went on to college. And there was a little bit of drinking when I was in school. Got drunk once or twice, and I found out in quick order I didn't like getting drunk because I like to be in control of a situation, mainly me. So after once or twice getting drunk and realizing how fast it can slip up on you, I more or less backed off booze. And while I was in college, I did a very dumb thing. I got married. There's no rhyme or reason. It wasn't a case of have to, it was just a case of, I don't know. I've got a theory on it, and some things are just better left unsaid. But anyway, this marriage lasted 10 years. And I was married to a boy that I, in my opinion, was an alcoholic, but I'm not responsible for his attitude or actions, so I can't really say. He did not like responsibility, would not assume responsibility, and had a lot of conflict with his mother who tried to run our marriage. And I came from the kind of family that told you stand on your own 2 feet and run your own life, and I didn't appreciate it. I'll say this, my mother-in-law was probably about the only woman that could have been kicked out of the Marine Corps for fighting dirty, because she's just that tough. But we stayed married 10 years, and we got divorced, had 3 children, and when we got divorced, the full responsibility of those children fell to me to raise. And I have always taken responsibility very seriously, maybe a little bit too seriously. He was in service, and the way I got to Valdosta, we transferred here from Amarillo, Texas. And I had been in Georgia before, been in Valdosta, because living up north, you know, you do go to Florida, and I could remember having been in Valdosta. And I rather looked forward to coming there, and a lot of my kinfolk were from the South anyway, and I always said I was a Southerner, just finally came home, because I love it here. And so I really looked forward to moving here. We came here, and we were pretty much separated, and I didn't say anything about us being on the verge of getting a divorce, and we'd been here not too long, and he got to go to Vietnam. And the story of it was, he was out juking, partying, and drinking one day. This happened all the time, and I had enough of it, and I went marching into the bar and says, come home. And he says, I'll be home after a while. And I said, if I wanted you home after a while, damn it, I would have come after a while. Come home now. He said, when I finished drinking my beer, and I poured it out on the bar, and I said, your beer is gone. The barmaid had a little thing going with him. She started to say something. I said, lady, let me tell you one thing. I've got three children and a home that I'm trying to protect. If you want to protect your teeth, shut your mouth. So I went out and got in the car and went home. He got out and got in his truck, and he went out to the base, drunk, mad, and volunteered to go to Vietnam. And you know what? They took him. And so I thought anybody that was that stupid, he'd already had a hitch overseas in Korea, and I thought anybody that stupid that would go off and leave a wife and three small children and volunteer to go to a place like Vietnam, okay, fine. He got over there and decided he didn't like it, so he rode home and he says, hey, you've got some political pull, see what you can do about getting me home. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do what you ask me to do, but I won't go to my family to do it. I'll go to somebody else who's got a little bit of political pull. They wrote a letter, it didn't do any good, and I sent him a copy of the letter and said, well, I tried. I needed some time away from him. At the end of the year, my children were saying, Mama, when Daddy comes home, can we still go to the movies? Or Mama, when Daddy comes home, will you still take us swimming? Mama, when Daddy comes home, can we still... They were dreading seeing their father come home, and so was I. So I made up my mind that that was it. Now, we come up to a real sore spot in my life, and that was the divorce. I came up in a family that had never had a divorce, and I was taught that marriage was forever and always. You made a marriage work. If you let one go down the tube, you were a failure. And I believed that. And I had tried and tried, and it was not getting better. It was getting worse. And I would think of him coming home, and I'd think, I'd rather be dead. I can't go through it again. I just could not. So in my inability to cope, I decided to kill myself. But I called my sister, lives down in Pompano Beach, and I was telling her my tale of woe, and I said, if something happens to me, will you see to it that my children do stay together, and I don't want mother and daddy to have them because they're too old. She said, Beverly, don't do anything foolish or rash. Call dad. I said, but I can't call him. I said, you know how mother and daddy feel about divorce? I said, my God, he'd kill me. Now, my whole life, I had sought my father's approval more than anything in the world. I didn't realize till he died how much I really had it. But she kept saying, no, Beverly, call dad. You'll be surprised. So I called my daddy, and I told him what my problem was. And I asked him, I said, what would you say if I got a divorce? He said, well, I'd say that's your business. I said, yes, but I know how you and mother feel about it. If I got a divorce, could I come home and be like one of the children, or would I be like unwanted company or something like that? It's very important to me what your opinion is. What would you say if I got a divorce? He said, baby, I tell you one thing, it's about GD time you did. And I almost fainted, because that man knew how miserable I was, and on every time I'd go home, I'd always play like everything was fine, because I was brought up that you don't take your trouble outside the family. If you're going to live with a man, you don't talk about him, and all these things. And I had just followed all these little rules because you're supposed to. Well, I have found out since I've been in AA that we're so hung up on the supposed to be's that we can't even live normal lives. And coming into AA, hopefully we begin to make some of the breakthroughs and get away from some of the supposed to be's. But my immediate problem on getting a divorce was money, because I was flat broke, lived in Valdosta, had bought all the house I could possibly afford in as nice a neighborhood as I could possibly buy a house in. I had three small children, so I needed money. So I told my dad what my problem was. He said, well, don't worry about it. He says, we can handle that. So he sent me enough money to handle all my other little problems and pay some bills off and buy that husband off and put me a little in the bank, and I was doing just fine. It became necessary at one point, and I tell you, I don't have too much sympathy for people who won't work for their children if they're able, and I guess I'm kind of hard-nosed about this because I worked three jobs at one time in order to put food and clothing on the for my children, and almost worked into exhaustion because I didn't want to hit my family up for any more. Those children were my responsibility. I had gotten myself into this marriage that didn't work, and I felt like it was my place and my job to see to my children. And I've always been lucky. For a woman, I've always made pretty good money. And when I first moved to Valdosta, I was so lacking in confidence that I just got a job downtown in an office. But I had some friends that kept saying, you know, you ought not to work there. You ought to work for Owens, Illinois. And I don't know if you know what OI is, but Owens, Illinois is the 87th largest corporation in the world. And one of the locations happens to be at Valdosta. We have a paper mill and a multi-wall bag plant. And I wouldn't apply for a job there because I was so insecure within myself. I didn't feel like I could get the job. I didn't feel like I was good enough. So I finally got enough courage and an awful lot of people pushing me, and I went down and I applied for a job. And jobs there, well, they're at a premium because they pay the most, and everybody and his brother wants one. There were 28 of us that applied for the same job, and I got it. And when I got the job, I thought, oh, hell. They picked the wrong girl. They got the wrong name. They didn't really mean me. But I went, and I showed up for work, and I've been there for over 15 years now. So with the job at OI and a set of books that I kept on the side, working nights as a waitress, we finally got perking along. I said I have three children. My middle child is a little boy, and when he was 6 years old, he had to have extensive surgery, not once but twice. And I had been introduced to a man that was, about 11 and a half, 12 years older than I was. Seemed to be perfect, but I'm smart enough now to look back. You know, hindsight's better than foresight. We have a maid that used to say, Miss Beverly, remember one thing, honey. If you run across somebody that seems to be perfect, watch that scoundrel. He knows his faults so well, he's got them well covered. Well, I ran into one of those scoundrels. He was perfect. He was very supportive of me whenever my little boy had surgery, and I was just really beside myself, real torn up still about this divorce, and he gave me a lot of courage, encouragement, courted my children. Oh, he was so kind to them, so good to them. Of course, the children say, Mama, won't you marry him? All my friends would say, Beverly, you ought to marry this man. And I didn't really want to get married. And then we had a few friends that they'd say, now, let me tell you, you got too big an age group there. If I were you, I'd back off that thing because he's not accustomed to children, and here you've got three small children. Watch what you're doing. And anyway, to make a long story short, we got married. Now, the truth of it is, I would never admit this at the time, but the truth of the whole thing was, I was looking for a knight in shining armor. I wanted somebody to come in and help me with those children, be company to me, help me make a living, and so I wouldn't have to be alone. I was looking for an easy out, and I took it. I thought an awful lot of him, but that still was, there was not enough there to have produced a marriage, and I took the easy out. All right, in turn for all of this, he was after something too. At that time, he was in business doing real well. He had been divorced for a period of time, and he wanted somebody that looked a hell of a lot better than what he had divorced, that he could flaunt around, that he could dress up like a baby doll and tell what to do. So I was to pay a price. I used to wear my hair so teased and so prissy, it was unreal. I wore more expensive dresses to work than the general manager's wife wore to parties, but that was all his idea. And it was not too long after we were married that I began to realize that the conflict was coming with children. And he had a real good way of getting to me. If I got my way on something or I insisted on something that was not what he thought we should do, that he would get to me through the children. Now, you know, the fastest way to a man's stomach's through his heart, but the fastest way to a mother's heart's through a child. Mess with my young and you've messed with me. So I began to be torn and have a buffer, try to keep a buffer between husband and children. And I'd say, damn you, you knew I had these three children before I got married. There's no way I could hide three children. And now you come up with this, the children drive you up the wall. You're driving them up the wall, too. And what would have happened, I don't know, but we had a little tragedy strike. I began to come down with bad headaches, and I began to have all kinds of problems. And we couldn't find out what the matter was. I used about every little old doctor there in Valdosta and Brooks County and all around, and finally went to Shands Hospital down in Gainesville. And I walked in, and I was carried out, because I got in there, and I was those people's good little guinea pig. And they were playing fun and games with me, and I could tell I was getting worse, and I got scared, and I threw a temper tantrum and come home. They wanted to put me in the nut house. And I got home, and when I got home, my doctor kept me asleep till he could get me into Emory. And when I was at Emory, they were able to tell me what was the matter. I had gotten into a chemical. At that time, we didn't know what it was. But it was causing the nerves to die as they left the central nervous system, and I was losing the use of an arm and a leg, and having severe headaches, had all the classic symptoms of having been poisoned. We found out later what I've got into. It was methanol in a Ditto machine. It was not ventilated as it should have been. And being a good old country girl, I count those wet copies, you know, and so I was getting it from my fingers, and I was breathing it through the pores of my fingers as well as through my lungs. finally it came to light what that problem was, and there's no cure for it. The cure is you get out of what you got into and let Father Time do the healing, and it's a very long, painful process. And there were 6 months that I was never out of pain. The pain pills and the shots they gave me only made it bearable. They never removed it. The only time I didn't hurt is if I was put completely to sleep. Pain on a continuing basis that never stops is nerve-wracking. And you climb the walls. And the severe headaches that I had with it and the nausea, every time I'd feel a headache coming on, I panicked. And I'd run get the shot. And then I think, well, maybe I got it too quick, so the next time I would wait, and the headache would get so out of hand that I think, oh, I'll never do that again. I didn't know if I hurt or didn't hurt. I was in a state of confusion. Well, during the period of time that they thought I was going to die, they tried to keep me out of misery. So they made available. All I had to do was walk in the emergency room and say, I'm here, I hurt, I got my shot. I always had a prescription for pain pills, and I was one of those people who had all sorts of allergies. And incidentally, I'm allergic to alcohol. I had to take antihistamines in order to drink liquor. But they found a pain medication called Taulin that I could take, and it's a mean drug. It makes you violently ill. So I got another little medication to go with it to settle my stomach. I was lucky. I was allergic to Valium and Demerol and all that good stuff, but you can get hooked on Taulin just the same. And I was hooked, and I knew it, and I was scared of it. And I would try to tell my doctor, look, I'm in over my head, and I wasn't knowledgeable enough about drug addiction to explain to the man, and I wasn't truthful either. I didn't tell him, look, I'm taking a lot of these pills that I don't need because I just damn it like to feel this good. I didn't tell that part of it. Well, he would explain to me why I could not be an addict. And I was thinking, but I know I am. Well, in the meantime, I found out that alcohol also kills pain. So I thought, now the answer to this, never knew what alcoholic meant. I was too stupid and didn't really care to go find out. This is my own fault. I should look further ahead. But all I cared about was the moment, what's expedient for right now. So I thought, well, I'll go ahead and I'll let loose of all this pain medication and I'll just take a drink whenever I hurt. And whenever I get over and done with all this, I'll just leave the drinking off and forget about it. Well, I didn't do it like that. I abused the drinking just as much as I abused the pills, and a lot of time put the two of them together. Let me tell you something. They say alcohol is cunning. My mind never knew the cunning on alcohol that it knew on drugs. But you combine the two, and I was dangerous. And I combined the two quite a few times. There were many mornings that I woke, and I was surprised to find I was still alive. And what would catch my attention was I would be awake, and I would be aware of it. And I would breathe so shallowly that it was calling attention to itself. It would be such a long span between breaths, and I would be in my bed with the covers up, the room be warm, and my body system had slowed down to the point that the circulatory system was barely working at all, and my body would be cold to the touch. And it was amazing to me. I think, my God, anybody that slowed their body system down this much and still wakes up, it's a miracle. But I never had enough sense to stop it. I never thought to thank God, you know, for letting me live. All I thought was poor little me, you know, and all this pain, and I knew this marriage was going down the drain. And I didn't realize that I had married another alcoholic, because, see, he could drink so much, and I thought it took a big man to drink in the quantities he drank in. I didn't realize till later, you just don't pick up a quarter of Jack Daniels or a fifth of Jack Daniels and be able to drink almost all of it down in an evening and not show the results of it unless you've been practicing some good time. Well, his boozing and then finances in business hit, and he made a business deal that went down the drain. He let his mouth overload his mind, and he blew a business deal he couldn't afford to blow that he'd spent quite a bit of money on. And something happened with him, in him, that never ever came back. And he got very abusive, and he got to the point where he slapped me around quite a bit. And this young son of mine is very partial to his mama. And I was scared to death that boy was going to walk in one day and see me catch it. And I knew that Mike was not big enough to stop this, but he had a 410 that made him about that big, a little shotgun I had given him. And I thought, Lord, I can't put a mark like that on my boy. And I knew it was coming. And the boy had asked if he could go live with his for real dad, because he couldn't stand me in drugs or in the booze. And somewhere in all that fogged up, drunked up mind, I had enough sense to let that child go. And for 4 years, I lost that only son. Now, that was a heartbreak that I suffered. I didn't mention it to too many people. It was very rare that I ever mentioned, you know, I miss him so bad I can't stand it. And I knew that it was my own undoing. And I gave that boy up because I didn't think he would ever come back to live with me. And I thought, I'll see him off and on, maybe once, twice a year, or every 2 or 3 years if I'm lucky, a postcard here and there. How many times will I see that boy till I die? And the prospect was not good. It was obvious that the marriage couldn't continue on. So we got divorced, and about the time we got divorced, the light of my eyes sort of was always my daddy. My daddy died. So much of what I have learned in AA is not new. I learned these things from him, but I had to come to AA to coordinate my life. And during the last year of my father's life, I spent as much time with him as I possibly could. And you think that wasn't a battle, keeping the fact that I was drunk every night from that old man. He may have suspected, but if he did, he never let on. I've told this at a meeting not so long ago. I wasn't drunk at his funeral, but I won't say I wasn't crocked the night before, and I won't say that the night that he was buried. Now, mind you, it's cold up there. When it freezes hard. And the day they buried him, I was cold sober, very hurt. And it came up dark time, and I just couldn't stand the thoughts of that man being in that cemetery that first night by himself. You know, it was just driving me out of my mind. So the darker it got, the more antsy I got. And the next news you know, I went down and got in my suitcase and got bundled up. And, of course, in the bundling up, I managed to snocker away a quart of vodka. And I went to the cemetery and squalled and bawled and drank all night long. Friend, that's sick. But I did it. I kind of lose my train of thought because there's so much that went on. You got a little background there, and this all just leads up to prior to coming to AA. Now, the most important part of my drinking was the last year that I drank, because it's that last year when I look back, I see the hand of God. He manipulated me, moved me, and put me exactly where he wanted me so that at the right time, he had me. Prior to the drinking, I had never been overly impressed by church. I had been scared to death by it. I was brought up on the hellfire and brimstone. And I remember telling my mother one time when I was a little girl, I don't want to be a Christian while I'm young. I want to wait till I get to be old, because I want to have a good time when I'm young. Then when I get to be old, I'll get to be a Christian, so I won't go to hell. And now, that's just what it meant to me. And you just stopped and think, didn't you think the same thing? If you did, your attitude about God was the same as mine. And then when we were living in Texas, I began to really reason out what God was. And I knew there had to be an awful lot of love. Now, I happen to be of the Christian faith. I call my higher power God, and I go the one step further, and I do identify Jesus Christ as being my Lord of all. And I began to reason that anyone that walked and talked the love that this man Christ did had to be a very loving person. And he sort of nicknamed John and James the Thunderers. You do that in jest, not out of hatefulness. Small children love him. Have you ever seen a child follow a sourpuss? The different things, I began to reason out how much love was there. Well, I came to the point where I could knew the love up here, but I could never feel it in my heart. But when I taught Sunday school, boy, I lied to those little old kids, and I know the good Lord overlooked that. I thought there's got to be a better way for these children, and I would tell them of the love and all the love that there was there. But I could, every now and then I'd feel it in my heart, but never, ever like I have since I've been in AA. But back to my last year of drinking, I had become dangerous in many ways. I was very careless about my life. Bought a new car that had a 400 engine, and there wasn't anything or anybody I wouldn't race. And I, hopefully, if I had a wreck and got myself killed, that was going to take me out of my misery. I would never kill myself with a gun or anything like that and put a mark like that on my children. And I didn't really want to die drunk. But I had planned out this clever little suicide, you know, and that was my way out. If it gets any worse, I can always kill myself. I had several friends that I'd ask little questions about first one thing, then the other. And I had planned out how I would commit suicide. I'd be sober when I did it. I'd commit suicide, but it would be an accident. That way my children would get the double indemnity. See, I was a good mama. And I'd like to say here that when my children were small, I would be eternally grateful that I was not a good mother. I was an outstanding mother. I played with them. I took up time with them. And I've always been proud of that for the simple reason there was come a time those children didn't have much of a mom to speak of. I was present, but I was absent. And they were ashamed of me. I embarrassed them. I embarrassed myself. I embarrassed my son to the point where he didn't want to live with me. But the last year that I drank, if I hadn't been so good at what I did and so programmed, I would have probably gotten all manner of trouble at work. But one of the things there towards the end that really scared me was we had bought a piece of equipment that we spent a little over $950,000 on. I had just made the last payment on it, and different people had copies of the contract and all the paperwork, but I had all the originals, the whole kit and caboodle that you need to keep, and I lost it. And I'd look in my holding tray, and I couldn't find it. I'd look in my file drawer there at my desk, and I couldn't find it. I'd go back and get a cup of coffee and stop by somebody's desk and BS and look at their desk over to see if maybe I'd left it back there a little bit earlier. There was no place I could find it, and I knew it was going to be asked for before the day was over, and I knew if I didn't have it, I was in serious trouble because $950,000 is no small piece of change. So finally I thought, well, if I had done what I normally would have done, what would I have done with it? I went back to the file and looked, and there it was, filed away where it was supposed to be, and I didn't even remember putting it there. I wasn't blacked out. I was so into my misery, poor little me, my troubles, my problems, my woe, how tough the world is, how I hated everybody. I was not functioning as a normal person. I was so into myself. And at that time, I hated everybody, just some people worse than others, and I was head of the list. And I began to date a fellow that drank like I did, and that was great because he never fussed at me and I never fussed at him. He'd pick me up and he'd say, babe, if you need a little help or anything, there's a care package under the seat. That meant break out the bottle, break out the cups, and let's have a drink, and I did. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I always say mother would be offended if you told her that her father was an alcoholic, but you ask her how he died, and she'll tell you he drank himself to death. My granddaddy was a doctor and well thought of, but he died after a series of strokes that were brought on by high blood pressure, which was inflicted by excessive drinking. He literally drank himself to death, but he wasn't an alcoholic, see, because he was a doctor and very well respected. So my knowledge of alcoholism was limited, but I tell you what, my intake of alcohol was phenomenal. Days off or weekends meant one thing. I could drink uncontrolled all I wanted for as long as I wanted, and I didn't have to do anything about getting straight till the night before I had to go back to work. Sunday evening, you know, we start straightening up to go to work the next day. I never missed a day of work over drinking. I was arsenic at what I did. I never missed a pay raise because of drinking, and I never failed to get the maximum pay raise that I could get on my job because I had to be perfect. If I did something wrong, someone might say that if I hadn't been drunk the night before or you little hungover today, somebody might guess the drinking, and I had to keep it well covered. And I didn't consciously realize that I was hiding the drinking. I was really good at what I did, but I tell you one thing, I was rough to work with. God, those people hated me. I know that whenever I went on vacation, they hoped I'd never come back. And now when I go on vacation, they say, gosh, I hate when you're gone. I just feel better when you're here. That's what AA does for you. You change. You become a human. I wasn't a human. I was an animal. Had I known then what I know now about alcoholism, I would have done a lot differently. I would have sought help. I would have gone to a hospital because my company's hospitalization would have paid for it. I didn't know. But this fellow that I was dating did know. Or he began to suspect, and he was afraid of his drinking. And he started going to AA. But he lived in Albany, and that made it real nice because, see, I could go with him, and nobody in Valdosta knew that I was going to AA meetings because I'd die before somebody, you know, God. You know what they do in AA. So I'd go to the meetings, and I'd, you know, play the martyr role, that isn't that sweet of that little girlfriend to come with that alcoholic boyfriend, and I needed it worse than anybody in the room. And I hated every meeting I went to. I hated every one of those people in that room. I resented it. But I noticed that whenever we'd leave, it might be at least 3 or 4 hours after we left the meeting before I took a drink. And then one Saturday night, there was a man that was standing up there talking, and he was telling about how he had always felt so unwanted and so inadequate as a child, and he hit me where I lived. Because I knew that I wasn't wanted. My gosh, I certainly wouldn't want a youngster at this age, and I know my mother didn't want me. They just kind of put up with me, and I just sort of went along with it, but I never really felt like I was a part of the family. I always felt different. I always felt like an outcast. I always felt like a misfit. And I have been a misfit mainly because I have made myself a misfit. But when that man stood there and he talked and I had the tears running down my cheeks, do you think I'd go pick up a white chip? No. I didn't want to stop drinking. I wanted to get it under control. And the harder I tried to get it under control, the worse it went out of control. And finally there came what is the final drunk. With all these allergies I've got, every now and then whenever I would take the antihistamines to drink, I'd misjudge and I'd get too much liquor and not enough antihistamines and have a bad reaction and land up in the hospital. And I did that one Sunday afternoon. And I threw a fit and got up and stormed out of the hospital because I didn't think they realized how serious it was, that they just thought I was drunk. I knew how serious it was because I could barely get my breath. But anyway, I did get the treatment that was necessary. And I woke up the next morning and I had all this remorse and guilt. And I thought, you know, I've had enough of this. And I began to think about those people in AA, and I thought, if those people that keep coming, every time I go, the only thing that's changed is they have changed clothes, but they're back, smiling faces, they're happy. If those people are alcoholics, what does that make you? You're a first-class mess. You don't have anything that what these people have. What are you? And I started home, and I did something I hadn't done in a long, long time. I began to pray, and I was going from Albany to Valdosta. And I was praying, please, dear Lord, give me the courage to go up there tonight, pick up a white chip, and do something about this drinking. And I just kept praying, and I looked up in the rearview mirror, and that 400 engine had me in trouble one more time. I'd had all kinds of courtesy warnings for speeding and been caught drinking several times. They all slapped a ticket on me if they give me a courtesy warning or turn their head or some little thing like that. But when I looked up this time, and you want to know the truth of it, I really don't think I was speeding. Because whenever I looked at the speedometer, I was dead on 55. And that car won't slow that fast, not where I got caught. But I felt so guilty, I just ate that ticket. And I got back in the car and I looked up and I said, thanks a whole lot, God. I really appreciate that. Here I am praying for help to stop drinking. You let a damn cop give me a ticket. And somewhere out of the back of my mind came this little voice that says, get thee behind me, Satan. And I thought, well, of course. Now, I believe in a force of good, and I also believe in a force of evil. And I thought, well, good grief, the devil sure doesn't want you to get straightened out. And I used to laugh and say the reason the good Lord came to my rescue is he looked down and he says, my gosh, if I don't do something about Beverly and that all that drinking she's doing, she's going to take half the population to hell with her. You know, if I straighten her out, maybe can save the rest of them. And it just dawned on me that there was a stumbling block. You know, there are always little things in your way. And so I thought, well, it's not the Lord's fault. I'm in the car. I'm responsible for the driving. So I just prayed a little bit harder. And all day long, I could feel this terrible, terrible struggle within a part of me that wanted to go, that wanted to stop, and a part of me that would say, you don't really need to go, you're not really an alcoholic, it's not necessary, and I just struggled back and forth, and it was like a real living thing. It was as though there were two people within me that were fighting terribly. I called a person who was in AA that I knew and asked if they were going to the meeting, and they weren't, and I thought, well, hell, I can't even get somebody from AA to go with me. And I went home, and it was seemed like forever to 8:30, and I walked the floor, and I got scared. And finally I thought, well, you little girl, you have taken a drink for everything under the sun, because it rained, because it didn't rain, because it's a holiday, because it's not a holiday, because it's daylight, because it's dark. Take a drink one time in your life for a good reason. Take a drink, pull yourself together so you can get up there and do something about this drinking. So I did, and it worked. I took two drinks, and I got up there sober, scared to death. And if you've ever been to AA in Valdosta, where I go is, during daytime it's downtown. During nighttime it's Skid Row, it's pretty rough. And I started up those stairs in that dingy building, and I'd never been up there before, and I thought, doggone, you see what you brought yourself to? You get up those stairs, and you do something about this drinking, and you get yourself straightened up, because, sister, you brought this one on yourself. So I got up there, and now prior to this, you've got to realize that I was a very willful, vain, proud person. Pride is a wonderful thing. Pride misused is dangerous. Having a will is great, but when you're willful, it's dangerous. I had so many wrong ideas, and the drinking had influenced my mind and warped my mind so much, I was just about as wild and crazy as anything under the sun. If I had been placed in a hospital for drinking, my vanity could not have taken it. Because to wind up in the hospital because of being a drunk, my God, that's the epitome of debauchery. I just could not have stood it. If I had been sent to Willing Way, I was clever enough, I would have gone along with the program to the point where I would have found a way I would never come out of Willing Way alive. I know me. I would have killed myself. My pride could not have taken it. What would the family think? What would the neighbors think? What would the people I work with think? I was in that kind of shape. Now, I was tragic. All right, I get up these stairs. They have the meeting. I'm not sure what they talked about, and to this day I swear that the room was very dimly lit. And they went around the room, and since I was the only person they hadn't seen in there before, they asked me, did I have anything to say? And for all that length of time, I've been sitting there thinking, can I say it? Can I say it? Because once I said those words, it was committed, it was out, and people had heard it, and I was hung with it. And I said the hardest words I've ever said in my life and the most important words I've ever said in my life. I said, my name is Beverly, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want you to know, you hear about these bad to say when I pray my way through and the bells went off and all this good stuff happened. Well, now that happened to me. Because whenever I said, my name is Beverly, and I'm an alcoholic, all of a sudden something did happen. I felt clean. I felt positive. And what really happened, God had forgiven me. I was living in sheer hell, and he knew it. I was sorry. I wanted out. I didn't know how to get out, and he knew that. He put me in a place where I could get the help that was necessary. And in the moment that I admitted before God and the whole living world, I didn't care who heard me. It didn't matter. I wanted help. But in that moment, I had become teachable. And whenever I could say it like that, all of a sudden, there was something positive, the first positive thing I had done for myself in years. I felt good about me. I felt clean. I felt a ray of hope, and hope is what makes us all go. God had forgiven me, but in that moment, I forgave Beverly. The forgiveness was there. I just hadn't bothered to accept it. I went in like a bag of jelly, and I walked out with a little bit of backbone because I knew I had something I could hold on to, and that was a higher power. I was drinking at that point a third to a half a quart every night because I had to go to work every day. But now, weekends, it was a minimum of a quart a day or more. I never went into DTs. I didn't have any problems like that. I just quit. I didn't go through a lot of the pain and hurting and agony that so many people do. And I know why. For the simple reason, God knew exactly what he was dealing with. And if he hadn't held me up, I couldn't have done it. There was no way in the world. So he more or less held on to me till I heard enough, and you people helped me enough that I could begin to kind of hold my head up and stand up just a little bit on my own two feet. But I have found that there are six words that I use to stay sober. I believe, help thou mine unbelief. You would think that when God came to a person's rescue like he did for me, that, you know, I'd have it on downhill drag. The spiritual part, I've got cornered. Well, friend, I don't. I lose it. There are times that I'll look up and I feel like saying, are you up there? Do you even know I'm down here? Do you care? And sometimes my unbelieving sight is so big it's almost into blasphemy. And I'll start that, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. And sooner or later something happens or someone comes. But now the real work really began. I got along fine for a while, and then I started to grow. And let me tell you, growing pains hurt. And I began to find out that I wasn't like a lot of the other alcoholics. You men think it's one thing to be a male alcoholic? Try being a female alcoholic. You know, we aren't very kind to each other. And if I'm going to step on Al-Anon's toes, that's too bad. Some of the Al-Anons aren't overly kind to female alcoholics either, because they sort of take the attitude, oh, I know what you used to do. Well, it isn't like that. It's a rough way to go. And some of the things that make it hard for us women is the fact that we are taught deceit from infancy up. We're taught that, you know, you don't like your hair color, change it. Your face doesn't look, put a little makeup on. You don't have enough up here, pad the bra, get one of those cute little gadgets and give you a little padded fanny. We are taught deceit from the, and encouraged in it, and you men encourage us in it. Now, when not so long ago, last summer, I was really struggling with a problem. And I had been home and I had seen a friend of mine, and she made a remark about I wasn't happy. And I said, oh, yeah. I thought, well, I've been in AA all this length of time. Of course I'm happy. She said, no. Says, I used to think of you as the most alive person I have ever known. Says, there's something, you're just not happy. And anyhow, we were talking, and spent about an hour talking, and then we got ready to leave. She hugged me goodbye. It was the last time I was ever to see this girl. She said, I'm glad to see that you're still the same warm person down deep inside. And that bugged me. Well, I've been home about a month, and I got a phone call one morning from a mutual friend, and she was hysterical. She had seen this girl go over the overpass and get killed. And she said, I had to talk to somebody that knew her back when we were young, that loved her like I did, and the only thing I could think was call Beverly. And these words haunted me. These words haunted me. And finally, came up the day of the funeral, I couldn't stand it. And all of a sudden, a whole lot of things started falling into place. No wonder the girl said, way down deep inside, I had begun to wear so many false faces. During the years I brought my children up, you know, I had to be rough, tough, and put on this fine act, because everybody that works for you, from the guy that's going to repair your car to the guy that's going to fix your air conditioner in the house, everybody's out to take you if you're a woman alone, so you got to come on like gangbusters. At work, I had to be rough and tough and good because I had to get the pay raises. I had to know more than anybody else. I had to laugh louder than anybody else. And I had put on so many false faces, I began to think, who am I? I don't even know who I am. And if you start taking the false faces down, you begin to find out that it's not easy. You talk about vulnerable. And the biggest job is, okay, you know what your problem is? That's two-thirds of it. Doing something about it, that's scary. But keeping the problem solved is the biggie. I get the false faces down and something come along. Not so long ago, I got thrown into a very competitive situation. I've got a competitive streak a mile wide. I was being mowed down. And I thought, I don't have to compete, and I don't have to play cutthroat like that anymore. But still, this little pride in me, like, you're going to let her out, do you? It took some kind of doing and some kind of praying. I almost got physically ill because I thought, look, you're dealing with a master at cutthroat. Don't think that you're riding over me. I'm just letting you do it. Anytime I decide I want to mow you down, girl, you don't know how to play the game. And it began to dawn on me, no, it really isn't necessary, because there's one thing that this person could never take away from me. That was the experience that I've got, and the fact that I have a little bit more patience and a little bit more serenity, and you run at things frantically, sooner or later you're going to fall down. So I just sat back and let it go, and lo and behold, I was gone for 3 days. In the 3 days I was gone, everything went to pot. I came back and I thought, well, thank God I didn't let superego overget me. And I found out about ego up here. Some fellow said ego is means easing God out. And I get into trouble with ego. I've either got super ego or zilch ego. And you're supposed to have a happy medium. And every time I get into trouble with myself or with my fellow man, it's been when I've been on an ego trip. I've been easing God out. I either think I'm Queen Beverly or I'm Beverly Nobody. But if I can get me in a happy medium, I do all right. Now, I was laughing a while ago. My time in AA has been fantastic. a little over a year ago, that son that I lost came home, and I didn't know he was coming till he got there. And he decided he'd rather live with his mother. He wanted to be with his mother, and he's there. And for Christmas this year, you think I'm not grateful and humble? My children gave me new carpet in my living room and hallway. And it didn't have to be that way. You know, I almost messed around and could have lost that house that we lived in. We didn't have to have a floor to put the living room on, the new carpet on. But here I've got new carpet, and my children thought enough of me to buy that new carpet for me. And that, every time I walk across that floor, I get humility, because it's fantastic. This little boy that couldn't even stand to be around me suddenly can't do enough for me, because AA has given me that. I was sober many years before I ever got drunk. I don't want to go back there. And if it took the liquor to bring me where I am today, where I have, see things out of the eyes that I see them, have the understanding and mainly the appreciation, if it took the liquor to bring me to this point, thank God for the liquor, but I don't want another drink. It isn't necessary. Okay, I'm going to let you people go. You've heard enough. I could go on about AA for hours and the wonderful people that I've met in AA, the many things that I have learned, but I will leave you with one little thing. When I was drinking, I knew fear, like I've never known fear before in my life. And occasionally I get afraid. I think I've talked to several people in AA who say that they still occasionally become afraid. And my little spiritual sponsor gave me something one day that came out of Timothy. And to me, if it isn't hope for the alcoholic, I don't know what is, because I was a very insane person when I found this program. And it goes, "For God did not give us a spirit of fear, but one of power and of love and of a sound mind." And if that isn't hope for an alcoholic, I don't know what is. I kind of rambled, but that's all right. I needed to see all these pleasant, wonderful faces. I've had a little personal problem, and y'all don't know what you've done for me. I appreciate you asking me to come up. And if you're ever in Valdosta, be sure to come by and see us. We'd love to have you. Y'all have a fine AA program up here, as evidenced by Alan, because we get so much of what is said up here in our meetings down there. And I love you all. I've always loved people, but I've never known how to love people till I got into AA. Thank you.